Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage as we travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, the future of Alaska energy. Hosted by the Society for Marketing Professional Services, or SMPS Alaska, Brent Petrie, who recently retired from the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, gave an overview of the proposal to build a natural gas-fueled power plant on Alaska's North Slope at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage on October 15th.
Good afternoon. I'm Cheryl Jamar, the SMPS Education Director for this year, and I work for USKH in the Marketing Department. I'd like to introduce our speaker today, Brent Petrie, recently retired from the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, where he managed the development of various projects, including renewable energy projects. Prior to AVEC, Brent served as the General Manager for the Iliamna Nuwaylan Non-Dalton Electric Cooperative, and while he was there, he oversaw the Iliamna Tasimina Hydroelectric Project, which produces 80% of the electric energy for the villages in the Iliamna area. Brett's career also includes serving in multiple positions, including Director of Planning and Director of Operations at the Alaska Energy Authority over the course of 13 years. Brett is now involved with the development of the All Alaska Energy Project, which he believes will provide more power to more Alaskans in less time than any other alternative presently available. Thanks for agreeing to speak to us today, and we look forward to your presentation.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's also a pleasure to not have snow on the ground by this time of the year, which we often do. I also want to say that my former boss, Mira Kohler, was originally invited to be here and couldn't be here today, but she also has quite a bit of information to add on this topic, and she usually does this type of presentation. Also in the audience is Steve Gilbert, my successor at Alaska Village Electric Co-op, and I know some of you know him. And he's very familiar with the concepts of this project and the technology. Before he came to AVEC, he worked at Chugach Electric Association and also with Alliant Energy, managing their several hundred megawatts of wind project in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. We're really glad to have him come back to Alaska. So this type of technology that I'll be addressing, high voltage direct current technology. There's been some other folks here in the Alaska business arena that have helped support looking into this, including Marsh Creek, who's one of the sponsors today, ABB, and Doug Johnson with Professional Growth Systems. So they certainly are deserving of some acknowledgement in this in the work that they put into this process. So one of the tipping points that is facing South Central and rural Alaska is the price and availability of energy. And two recent studies done by Commonwealth North address this in a fair amount of detail. In 2009, there was a study group that addressed issues in the rail belt, and that was the study came out in 2009 called the Rail Belt Predicament. In 2012, that group also came out with another study called the Rural Conundrum. Basically, in a nutshell, South Central Alaska has rising prices for gas and concern about the availability of gas, which affects the supply of our major gas utility, NSTAR, as well as all of the electric utilities in South Central that use gas for power generation. And then in rural Alaska, we have pretty much everybody is on diesel for power generation. There are some isolated hydros and some wind being developed, but for the most part, diesel fuel is the the main fuel. We have we really don't have regional grids to increase efficiencies and reduce redundancy and add renewables. The study group identified a number of things to try to improve the situation, including ways to reduce diesel fuel consumption, proposing a single entity to coordinate generation and transmission, consolidating permitting into a one-stop shop situation, and surprisingly, the group wanted to find a way to eliminate the need for the power cost equalization program, basically through technology investments in power supply and transmission. This slide shows what we're spending today on power generation and revenues in all of Alaska, including South Central and the rural area. So basically, electricity revenue is a little over $1 billion in South Central. Gas revenue is about almost $600 million. Diesel fuel, Fairbanks, the heating fuel for Fairbanks is mainly diesel fuel. So there's a significant amount of diesel fuel used in Fairbanks for that purpose, as well as for power generation. We also have diesel used by the larger utilities like Kodiak and Copper Valley Electric, Bethel Utilities, Kotzebue Electric, 68 million gallons in Southeast Copper Valley and Kodiak. And then the rest of Alaska is about 160 million. Altogether, if you take that at $4 a gallon, which what we might pay here in the Anchorage area, that's about $1.6 billion for diesel fuel. Add the electricity revenue to that, and in Alaska, we're spending about $3 billion a year on electricity and fuel for energy and power. So that's kind of a target number to look at eating into and reducing if we could. The situation in South Central Alaska, our current gas-fired power generation, it's not sustainable unless we find more resources and put more investment into pipelines and supply. Current gas supplies, according to information provided to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and contracts that NSTAR and Chugach and others have, the current gas supplies only seem to be assured through 2018. In Fairbanks, they're utilizing diesel for half of their electric generation and most of their space heating. The fact in Fairbanks is that your heating bill can be as much or more than your mortgage. It's a significant part of your budget to live in Fairbanks. In rural Alaska, diesel systems are the tried and true systems for the most part. They can be repaired, they can be supplied, but the rising energy prices of fuel create an unaffordable and difficult situation. As an example, Alaska Village Electric Co-op, its fuel costs have risen 300% in 10 years. So, and I know in some places that AVEC serves, rivers have changed course, and fuel has to be delivered by air. The fuel supply to some of those villages can be as much as $10 per gallon. That's the delivered cost, and then if a local entity, a store, is also receiving fuel that way and then reselling it for heating purposes, it can be more than that. In addition, in terms of rising prices, the cost per 1,000 cubic feet of gas in the Anchorage area, there's recently a contract approved for NSTAR, and that gas price is over $7 per MCF, which is about 60% more than it was 10 years ago. So our future, we have a number of issues that many of you have been involved with and looking at. One is declining oil production. And if we continue to have declining oil production, that's going to make our current economic situation unsustainable. We've been relying on boom or bust resources in many parts of Alaska still. That's not a sustainable way to work. And then by exporting fish and minerals that we dig out of the ground and not doing anything else with them, eventually we're going to run out, and that's unsustainable. So But one of the bright spots on the horizon is the reports from Department of Natural Resources and others indicate that on the North Slope, there's 235 trillion cubic feet of technically recoverable natural gas. So if you were to consolidate all of the energy needs for Alaska, add a few more, and build a 5,000 megawatt power plant on the slope, you would still have enough gas to run a 5,000 megawatt power plant for 1,000 years. That's the kind of quantities that we're talking about. So actually there's, you know, there's some comments that we've received that this power project on the North Slope might compete with other uses such as a gas line, but the fact is there's so much gas there it likely would not be a competitive factor. The other thing to consider is that gas extraction techniques. Some of you, probably your companies are involved in things like the Bakken prospect in North Dakota. Some of you might be involved in the shale prospects in Argentina, which are huge. So fracking is going to continue to be a technology that's going to open up more and more gas supplies throughout the world. And with expansion of these gas supplies, it's possible that our gas on the North Slope could still stay stranded as other parts of the world look to other places to supply their gas needs. So one question becomes, might there be other ways that we could use this very plentiful, relatively inexpensive, locally, energy source for all Alaskans? Next. But one idea that has grown out of investigations in the past is to look at a large-scale natural gas-fired power plant on the North Slope and move the power through a high-voltage direct current transmission line to various load centers. And this concept, it was briefly considered in the 1980s when I was at the Alaska Power Authority. It was looked at as an alternative to the Susitna project, but for a very brief period of time. At that time, it was looked at as an AC transmission system from the North Slope. AC does have some issues with loss and redundancy. And also, the state was on track to try to do a much larger Susitna project at that time, a 1,600 megawatt project. So it was put on the shelf and set aside, and eventually we all know that that first version of the Susitna project was shelved as well. The concept of generating with gas on the slope and sending power long distances, that was reconsidered in the 1990s by ARCO. And they looked at a concept of building a large power plant and shipping the power through DC lines to the lower 48. Some of those studies were used to try to, as a basis for numbers and a basis for updating the numbers that we have today. So that was set aside in the early 1990s. You know, the climate was such, let's keep working on looking at a gas line, and we're kind of still there today. But one other thing has happened, and that is HVDC transmission systems in the last 15 years. The technology has significantly advanced. The efficiencies of the converter stations has improved, and the relative cost of those converter stations has improved over what it was 20 or 25 years ago. The other thing that's happened is the size, the real estate that you need to do these converter stations has also reduced. So the exposure to the elements, weather, earthquakes, things like that, you've reduced that exposure through these improvements in technology. It would appear that this could be an option that could offer abundant and affordable power for operations on the North Slope. Many of the power plants on the North Slope are vintage late 1970s. There are single-cycle gas turbines. They're not as efficient as turbines that would go in today. For example, the South Central Power Project is a combined cycle unit where the first turbines generate power, then they also generate steam with the exhaust and run another turbine. So the efficiency on the use of the gas is much more. The carbon emissions are much less with a combined cycle unit than with a single cycle unit. This is something that could be done on the North Slope to reduce the carbon footprint and upgrade generation. Through transmission, You could connect to interior rail belt and rural communities. There's a lot of loads that those of us in the public utility business don't consider. These are industrial loads, but in fact, a transmission system might be a tipping point for some remote mines, military facilities, other industrial customers to hook up to such a transmission system and become anchor customers. North Slope Power Generation, if you concentrate generation there, basically you would have large generation capacity. It would be more efficient, likely more affordable. Connecting the rail belt and other consumers, you would have a larger customer base. Again, I'd address the issue of lower emissions. If we had gas-fired generation delivering power to rural Alaska, we would be displacing diesel fuel, which has a large carbon footprint as compared to gas. And it would provide a way for us to take this stranded gas that's on the slope to market. I mentioned a little bit earlier about high voltage direct current transmission. It's a proven technology. The things we're talking about here are not R&D. Basically, we're talking about taking off-the-shelf components, assembling them with recognition for the cost that it takes to do business in Alaska, and putting packages together of power generation plants, power transmission lines, converter stations. It's all off-the-shelf technology, although we haven't assembled such a package here in Alaska yet. It is used other places in the world. It's used all over the world for transmitting large blocks of power long distances. I mentioned that some of the systems today are much smaller footprint than the systems that were available 20 years ago. If we had a transmission system, it would increase the market for the existing generation that we have. There would be a pathway to send those electrons to market. It could be the existing infrastructure in the rail belt could be better utilized. Some of the examples of where HVDC has been used, actually it's been in commercial use since 1954 when Sweden connected islands in the Baltic Sea to the mainland using high voltage DC technology. And that particular system, since it was built in 1954, has subsequently been upgraded and is still in use today. Other places, in the late 1970s in Southeast Africa, there was a very large project, 1900 megawatt project, with about almost 900 miles of HVDC transmission line built. And then the West Coast, the area of Washington and Oregon are connected to California through something called the Pacific Intertie. That's a DC line. Utah and California have a connection. In the recent years, Quebec and New England have been connected. And the large-scale pioneers in HVDC transmission are right now the Chinese. They're putting very large projects together with thousands of megawatts being transported hundreds of miles. The latest project is a hydro project in western China, delivering power to the Shanghai area, and that's 6,400 megawatts and about a 1,300-mile-long transmission system. Europe is looking at ways to interconnect many of their systems across the borders, and in some cases they're connecting offshore platforms in the North Sea with the mainland using DC. In fact, there's a converter station on a platform in the North Sea. Not so far away in Canada, in Manitoba, they've been using HVDC systems since the early 1970s. The first phase of a Manitoba hydro project on the Nelson River delivered power to Winnipeg over a 500-mile-long line. This system in Manitoba might have good examples of how we could do some things here in Alaska. The systems are similar in size. They're similar in magnitude. There's permafrost involved in about 20% of the transmission line route in Manitoba, and they have weather issues there. And many of the miles of this system, there is no road, but they do have methods to recover from storms and outages. Basically, they have pre-assembled towers together, and if they have an icing or storm event, they're out there pretty quickly putting it back together. About 68% of all the power in Manitoba flows over that HVDC line to the north. Asia, I mentioned the recent project. There's also another even larger 8,000 megawatt project being planned that should be online in 2014. Again, that's coming from hydro facilities in western China to the east coast of China. North America, we have the lines on the west coast, Quebec to New England, and some lines connecting systems in the Midwest, as well as the Manitoba Hydro System. So this HVDC concept of a backbone from the North Slope to the rail belt and onward to the west, it could support rail belt utility projects, provide heat as well as power from Fairbanks. If the kilowatt hours were priced properly, it could be used for electric heat. We would be able to harness some of the remote renewables, such as wind on the North Slope, wind along Western Alaska, using turbines that would be a much more economical scale than what we're using today. There's other prospects that could be opened up, such as tidal and geothermal, as well as hydro resources that are stranded as well. The team that's been looking at this feel that properly priced electricity would provide value-added industry, such as processing of ore, lower emissions, fewer greenhouse gases. How this might be done, we think it lends itself to being a phased approach. First phase would be a power plant on the North Slope that could provide power for North Slope activities. A lot of the compression on the North Slope for gas and reinjection is done mechanically. That could be done electrically. A line to the Fairbanks area could provide power to the Fairbanks utilities, Golden Valley Electric. Also, it could provide electricity for the Fort Knox mine and energy for the Livengood mining district. The cost of that whole transmission concept, based on the information that we had in the old ARCO report and updated, that would be about $1.65 billion. I think we're at about $2.5 billion for the generation plant and some of the system improvements around Prudhoe. Yeah. So then another option would be extending this system to the west coast. One could go a northern route, or you could go further south and figure a pathway to the west along the Yukon or an area quite a bit to the north of that. It could provide power for the Ambler Mining District, Red Dog Mine, the Kotzebue Nome area, and it could also be a collector of wind power that could be generated along the west coast, where we have some class 6, some very high value wind regimes. A further build out of such a system would be the Yukon-Kuskokwim system. And again, anchor customers in that area could be the Bethel area and the Donlin Creek mine if it is developed. And then South Central HVDC transmission, it'd be a pathway that could be used to integrate and supplement the existing generation that's here. The system could be used to move hydropower from Susitna-Watana and could also be used to integrate other renewables such as tidal, geothermal, or wind, say with an expansion of Fire Island. That whole build out for South Central, again, based on the earlier numbers, it's about $1.2 billion. So all five phases, the capital cost, are about $7 billion. So that $7 billion compares to items that are on the drawing board right now that total about $16 billion. So it would seem to be an alternative that would warrant some additional investigation and costing to see how it could fit in or supplement these other alternatives. Some of these other projects that are underway in the South Central area, we're not getting that much additional generation from it. We're replacing and upgrading about 193 megawatts of generation, but there's an immense amount of need that's unmet by the utilities that could be met by such a system. Here's a listing of North Slope operations, conversion of gas turbines that are on the slope, various mining district loads. We found information in reports of a party that was interested in a server farm on the North Slope, and the power requirements for that were in the neighborhood of 500 megawatts. So adding a list here of various entities that could be anchor clients or tenants to such a system gets us over 3,000 megawatts. Again, the reserves that are estimated on the North Slope are 235 trillion cubic feet. We had questions if this kind of project would compete with some of the existing uses or proposed uses of gas for a gas pipeline, and we did some calculations basically. In short, a 5,000 megawatt power plant, there's enough gas on the slope for 1,000 years of operating that plant. So you can do some of these other things that are proposed with gas on the slope, as well as put a very efficient power plant there that would transmit power through a very efficient transmission line. In terms of permitting such a project, I mentioned we're not, this kind of project uses components that are in essence off the shelf, turbines that are built by, you know, people like Siemens and General Electric and Rolls-Royce. The stuff, plants that make this kind of equipment already exist. The HVDC components are made by large companies. So in terms of supply, you have to fit into the ordering system and supply chain, but you know, once you place an order for equipment, it probably could be done in 5 to 7 years. There's existing rights of way from Prudhoe Bay to the rail belt that could be utilized. New rights of way would have to be found to go to some of the places to the west, but there are some companies that have been working on routes for those pathways already. Anyway, it certainly seems like this concept merits some additional investigation for cost verification, for identifying participants that might wish to be anchor tenants of anchor customers of such a system. Would like to make some things here in Alaska rather than keep shipping things out of Alaska, and we're going to need electricity to do that. So having a grid would be the last word in being able to do that. So that's it. A lot more work left to do, but I think a lot of you here in this room, you work for companies and you have clients that inquire about this sort of thing. So as these kind of issues get on the table and you have clients that are wondering, where's my power supply going to come from, and we'd encourage you to encourage your clients to think about this as an option and maybe investigate it further. Take any questions.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Brent Petrie, formerly of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. His talk on the future of Alaska energy was recorded at a meeting of the Society for Marketing Professional Services, or SMPS Alaska, on October 15th. We have a link to his PowerPoint presentation as well as the All Alaska Energy Project website at alaskapublic.org. Following Brent's presentation, he responded to questions from audience members. The first audience member to raise her hand said, "One of your example transmission lines ran from New England to Quebec. Would it be possible to construct something similar running from Alaska to the Yukon?"
It certainly seemed like it would be something worth talking about. I know in Southeast Alaska there have been discussions with BC Hydro about having interconnections to various places in Southeast. That's kind of on the shelf for the time being, but seems like about every 5 years, Alaska and their and colleagues in British Columbia do have some dialogue about that. I would, you know, 20 years ago, I worked with a group called Northern Canada Power Commission. While I worked for the state of Alaska, we had a team looking at interconnections through the White Horse area and in the northern part of southeast Alaska. So it certainly seems like that would be a concept that could be dusted off, could be part of a dialogue that we have between leaders here in Alaska and leaders in Yukon and British Columbia. It's a good question.
Another audience member asked, how much gas would you need to get this project started?
An initial project, say a 1.75 gigawatt project, that would take about 76 billion cubic feet per year. And anyway, that's the volume. Exactly where it would come from, it's a complex situation in gas ownership on the slope in terms of where the gas is and where it's in essence surplus to existing needs and where it can be transported. So certainly needs to be some more work done in how that those pieces could fit together. But we'd be looking at less than 100 billion cubic feet per year for an initial project.
The second question from the audience was, what organizations or groups are working to support this project?
Well, Alaska Village Electric Co-op is involved in further exploring this, and Marsh Creek has been involved in providing funding for an individual who has worked on this concept before. There are some suppliers of equipment that are interested. They've provided numbers on, you know, cost of cable and cost of systems. So in terms of, you know, a political organization, it's not. It's more an assemblage of suppliers and utility types at this point.
Does your $7 billion in capital costs include processing? And what is your basis for the cost of gas?
Cost of gas, the basis for the cost of gas on the slope, you know, this is basically a capital project, but the cost of gas and the scenarios that were displayed here was $3 per MCF. So, but you could do a sensitivity analysis, and you could use 4, you could use 5. The actual overall cost in terms of like cents per kilowatt hour wouldn't be changing that much because the main cost is capital, and it's the interest expense on that capital that's a huge cost. We use 7%. For the cost of capital. So if you could get, and there's no grant involved, there's no state contribution. So it seems enticing enough with, you know, going out on the market, raising money or borrowing money at 7% that it merits some further examination.
Next, another audience member said, it seems like local utilities would have to be involved in this project. How would you get ambitious, competitive utility companies to cooperate?
Well, it might not. The main load might not go there. A significant amount of the load, certainly they would be. It would be nice to have them as anchors and participants. I mean, they carry a lot of, you know, political clout to help finance and permit things, but there could be other entities, mining loads and industrial loads, that could be significant users of electricity over such a system. But your question is, how do you do this? I don't know. It's how do you get them cooperating? There's various organizations and entities that have done that or tried to do that in the past. You know, frankly, you know, the Alaska Energy Authority, it used to be a good vehicle to gather all them together. It was kind of a whipping post for all the utilities. So, but, you know, the Anchorage Fairbanks intertie, it got built. It's a, you know, about 130-mile long intertie between Anchorage and Fairbanks. All the utilities, they have a project management committee that is involved in the operation of that. Bradley Lake was built through a cooperative effort. It was built by the state, financed by the state, but there are contracts out there to pay for that.
Any thoughts on what would happen to the resulting rejected thermal energy on the North Slope?
No, but you have good ideas. I just came back from Iceland, and there are greenhouses all throughout Iceland that are using thermal energy out of the ground. It might be a little bit of a stretch to have greenhouses on the North Slope, but Iceland's not, for a large part of the year, it's not a really, sunbathing kind of place to be. But a lot of their local produce comes from something they produce locally using, to them, excess thermal energy. And they're doing it at the location where the thermal energy is. They're not sending that energy long distances. Anyway, it's a place I encourage everybody to go take a look there. I'm ready to go back.
You gave many examples of HDVC projects all over the world. Are you aware of any example projects using natural gas for power generation and then HDVC to move that over a distance similar to what's being discussed in Alaska?
I don't have a specific example. I believe there are some cases in the Mideast where there are gas-fired power generation plants, and DC is involved in part of the movement of that electricity, but it's likely not a long distance. But you're asking a good question. That's certainly renewables are involved. In a lot of ways, it's used for systems that are incompatible with one another in terms of, in Europe, a 50-cycle system is connected to a 60-cycle system, and power is moved back and forth. And that's done in South America as well. I didn't have any South America examples, but Brazil and Paraguay have different frequency electric systems, and they use DC to connect those two systems together. So you ask a good question that would be good to have an answer to, so we'll research that. Any other questions? I don't know that there are many other places that have as much gas stranded as we do right now, with so much activity going on around the gas field.
The last question from the audience was, would burning this gas and shipping electricity affect the stranded designation of the gas on the North Slope?
Well, that's what we had here in Cook Inlet for decades. We weren't shipping the gas other than we had an LNG plant and we made fertilizer. So they found ways to monetize the Cook Inlet resource. Generating power on the North Slope with gas and selling that power would be a way to monetize the gas resource on the slope for a narrow purpose. Well, thank you very much. And
you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Brent Petrie, formerly of the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Following his talk entitled The Future of Alaska Energy, Brent responded to questions from audience members. You can find a link to his PowerPoint presentation as well as the All Alaska Energy Project website at alaskapublic.org. The Society for Marketing Professional Services Alaska, or SMPS Alaska, hosted Brent Petrie at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage on October 15th, 2013. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online anytime at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Platt. Thanks for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.